Thank you all for coming this afternoon. Got a good group. We were hoping for tables to be set up around here so we could have breakout into kind of a round table discussion session, but the way that the room's set up isn't really conducive to that, so we're going to go to Plan B. So we're going to have a presentation and then an open discussion. So put on your thinking caps, and we really hope that we can engage you all and get some good discussion going. So I'm Catherine Cooksley. I'm the moderator for the session, and I am so pleased to introduce to you Dr. Hardy Lowe. Dr. Lowe is a especially favorite person of mine. He was one of my professors when I was doing my MPH program. He's always been my favorite. Dr. Lowe got his MD at UTMB, the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas, where I currently work, in 1955, and then did his internal medicine rotation at Georgetown in 1960, and got his MPH at Berkeley in 1967. He then went on to become a public health, after other stuff, went on to become a public health physician at the Houston Department of Health and Human Services for 4 years, where he was an assistant director, and then went on to the University of Texas School of Public Health in Houston and taught for 35 years, 15 of which he was either assistant or associate dean of community health. We're very pleased, I'm very pleased, to introduce Dr. Lowe, who will be talking to us on social determinants of health and working within the communities for a healthier community.
Thank you, Catherine. I can assure you that favoritism goes both directions. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this subject because I don't know very much about it. However, when it first hit the news wires, it seemed clear to me that this was an important new direction for everybody to think about. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the course of the presentation. The other thing logistically is it looks like the way this room is set up, the principal recipient of my conversation will be that column right there. But I hope I can get through to the rest of you somehow. Okay. Well, I guess that, and you see the first slide, unfortunately the answer is none. I would greatly have preferred that there were some sort of financial remuneration that I could have to not worry about. Now, tell me, page, yeah, I got it. All right. Implications for public health interventions. Now, as you'll see later in the discussion, public health has always been focused on before rather than after disease. But the social determinants allow us to think about how we can move that even further ahead of time. The seeds of that are in the public health system that we have. So we'll look a little bit, if you'll forgive me, at the history of the development, very little bit, of public health systems in England and in the United States. Two people come out, a guy named Edwin Chadwick in England and Lemuel Shattuck in Massachusetts, a long time ago. Chadwick wrote the article, the report that you see there after many years, The Sanitary Conditions of the Laboring Population. And before that time, there was not much thought given to what determinants of illness or injury might be. So here's the first guy who says the living conditions may have something to do with it. And the laboring population, that implies something about their income, doesn't it? And about his report preceded Lemuel Shattuck's report, as you can see on the slide. Lem Shattuck wrote his report for the Massachusetts Sanitary Commission. It's kind of interesting to me that at that point in time they had a sanitary commission. If you look at the history of public health, After 1850, there's a regular proliferation of local and state health departments that developed over that time. But before 1842 in England and 1850 in the United States, there wasn't much organized public health. The issue about public health was mainly a sanitation one. So it's not surprising that these two guys did sanitation reports. We thought that the way to take care of yellow fever and other things like that was just to clean up the place and not have debris and junk and things for rats to grow up in and so forth. So that was the beginning. They identified poor sanitation as the major determinant of the problems that these people had. So that, as you can see then, our systems came from that. Well, after a while, considerably after a while, although there were other people along the way, people began to realize there was more to public health than sanitation. The first guy who stands out in my mind is a Canadian, Marc Lalonde. And he was not a physician, not a public health professional. He was simply a politician, Canadian Minister of National Health and Welfare. And he was seized with what it was that made people ill or well and wrote this landmark document, A New Perspective on the Health of Canadians. One of the things that came out of that is the development of health promotion. Health promotion per se, up to that point, was individuals who happened to think that way. But now it began to take on some organization after Lalonde's report. A few years later in this country, our Surgeon General, Julius Richmond, latched onto the same idea of early intervention, identifying those things that produce ill health. And so he wrote Healthy People, and then the series that we now have every decade about goals for people's health, health promotion and disease prevention. So these two people stand out as big promoters to get beyond the initial notion that dirt's bad for you to a whole lot of other things about what not might just bad for you, but what might be good for you as well. So what are our current public health systems all about? Here's what we do now, most of us, in most health departments around the world. Infectious disease, that one is a no-brainer. We're all scared to death of epidemics of infections that we don't like, and especially nowadays, the notion that some foreign country, much like our own State Department and Department of Defense, might afflict us with some kind of infectious agent. It's become a part of warfare. But infectious disease remains an important part of every public health department's armamentarium. Maternal and child health, largely focused in health departments on low-income populations, but recognized the importance of health during pregnancy, health during early childhood and development. So we spend an awful lot of time productively with services of that sort to keep little babies, their mothers, and children well so that they don't get sick in the first place. Chronic disease, we're getting more and more into that. By the way, if you look at the population at risk, I'm talking health departments, so you can see it's not the general population that we have focused on until recently. That varies from one community to the next, of course. Some health departments are more generic in their approach to their populations at large. Some are focused clearly on low-income populations, and I suspect part of that is because of the ethic in this country that says you surely shouldn't spend public money if you don't have to on somebody. And one way to avoid that is to limit it to poor people. I think that's beginning in subtle ways to be a little bit more broadly based than it used to be in terms of who the recipients might be of these services. Exposure to unsafe and contaminated foods. Sanitation, we still do that. We still inspect restaurants, probably make a major part of our income in health departments from the fees, et cetera, and the fines that go with that. And I tell you, I was quite happy that that's going on last night when I went to a Thai restaurant not too far from here and had some great duck. And I was happy to know the duck was probably okay because of what goes on in the health department around here. And then environmental hazards, that's growing by leaps and bounds. That one affects the population at large. Perhaps the biggest exception of that is the immediate environment of manufacturers, institutions. People who are indigent tend to be able to afford rents and locations that often are in industrially hazardous areas, close to plants and so forth, whereas people who can afford it move out further to the nice country. And low access to medical care and public health services. Let's not slight the things we do know how to do in terms of interventions in medicine, interventions in public health. Our focus in health departments is on low-income populations, but you can hardly ever keep up. So what's the issue? The issue is the timely correction of determinants of illness. This allows early intervention to maintain health, it allows you to avoid ill health at all if your intervention is appropriate and early enough. The traditional definition of determinants, if you recall Shattuck and Chadwick, was that they would avoid the unhealthy problems of the laboring populations if they focused on the correction of sanitary deficiencies. Then the timely application of preventive measures or early treatment. If you can't get it early, then treat it as early as you can. I will insert a personal anecdote, if you'll allow, here. Probably the reason I decided to go to Berkeley after I stopped being an internal medicine doc and get an MPH was, along the way, I enjoyed clinical medicine just fine, but every now and then, I would run across somebody that perhaps we'd done very fine diagnostic work and so forth, only to discover here was an illness that you couldn't do anything about. The person was going to die no matter how early you caught it, no matter what. And that happened enough that I decided there must be a better way. And public health looked to me like it might be that better way. It gave us the opportunity to have interventions so that some of these fatal or at least difficult illnesses and injuries that occurred might not happen at all, which is what this is about, really. Okay, I think that's pretty obvious what that is. Here's a couple of examples, though, to let you know what I actually mean. If the health risk is diabetes, the health problem that you identify is a high fasting blood sugar or glucose tolerance test, usually. Although better educated people now know their risk factors and may come in before they have a blood test done. So what's the intervention? You confirm the diagnosis and you treat the disease. Okay. What about on the environmental side of the house? Air quality. The health problem is the exposure to an increased level of toxic emissions. So you control the emission. But if you wanted to go one step further, you might say, what's causing the emission in the first place? Should we continue to manufacture this item in the same way we do, or should we get rid of it altogether? A better example of that, for example, in the automobile industry is the evolution of the electric automobile. Although I'm sure somebody's going to find a downside to that product as well, but it won't be like the air quality problems related to gasoline emissions from cars. Okay, that's what we've been doing, the traditional approach and so forth. So what are social determinants of health? Well, they are the drivers of risk and poor health. And they have to do with these different items here. The way we act, the way we behave can produce ill health. If our income isn't adequate, we will have poor health, almost a certainty. If the social environments, and we're learning a lot more about that now, And I'll show you a little bit more later, though, about things like making neighborhoods walkable, making neighborhoods places where you can buy healthy food at the grocery store. So the social environments, the economic environments, of course, are linked with the entire risk of being poor in the first place. The neighborhoods that are populated entirely by poor people are developed in the same low capitalization way that guarantees that the environs are not necessarily going to be helpful in the first place. Education, how much you know has an awful lot to do with how well or how ill you are. I know I'm talking to the choir, you know all this stuff, but I feel obligated to make the list. If you are not, you can correlate health status almost with years of education. You can correlate income almost with years of education. And so the issue becomes, what do you do about that? If you can't give everybody a large salary, what can you do in lieu of that? The political and economic systems, that's a little bit harder to get your arms around. But certainly, people in low-income neighborhoods get treated differently by the political system than people in high-income neighborhoods or middle-income neighborhoods. They have better access to control of decisions if they're in high-income neighborhoods. So the political and economic systems are an important driver of risk and poor health. And finally, discrimination. Depending on what we look like, how we behave, how old we are. I'm happy to say that nobody has dumped on me yet because I'm an older citizen, but I'm waiting for it. Sexual preference, as we all know, that's a big issue in terms of discrimination and opportunities and so forth, but becoming along. So, this is what the social determinants are all about. What can be done to influence how much money people make? What can be done to influence the healthfulness of their neighborhoods? What can be done to influence the ability, regardless of income, to have access to healthful foods? And so we'll see some of those things as we go along here. By the way, anybody who wants to speak up and add to anything or subtract anything from what I'm saying, please feel free to do that. If we can, sooner we make this a give and take, the more educational it'll be for all of us, including myself. Okay. Is this deja vu? Haven't we always done this? Haven't public health departments always intervened before the fact? Haven't public health interventions always been based on determinants? Well, in a general sense, yes. But the question is, how early and which determinants and what is possible to do? And we'll look at some things here. If you have a broader focus on this, then it means your opportunities to intervene are broader as well. Your opportunities to intervene early before things even develop or improve. So the standard early intervention theme of public health is simply improved by a consideration of the social issues that people are exposed to. The logic then suggests that if you address things very early and a broader set of things than you did before, that health status itself may rise. So, how do you do that if you're a health department? How do you do these broader-based things that really you weren't taught about when you got your public health education and so forth? Well, first of all, you can broaden the scope of your public health interventions. Can you develop some kind of program within your health department that begins to address the nature of a neighborhood, that begins to address the food supply and where it comes from and what can be done to influence that? The second thing you can do, you can increase working in collaboration with other sectors of society, and we're seeing that an awful lot these days. Partnerships are springing up all over the place between public health people and law enforcement people and people who generate income, look for jobs, and so forth. I am a member of a partnership in the state of Texas whose purpose is to try to reduce or prevent heart disease and stroke. And if you look at the membership of the people, this is about 140 people. If you look at the membership, it ranges from everywhere from pharmaceutical houses to clinical personnel to public health personnel, nutritionists. It's a very broad-based set of people who all come together and bring their experiences and their skills to bear on this one issue. What can we do about reducing heart disease? What can we do about reducing stroke? Clinicians are part of this as well. So it's very uncommon in my experience that you can find places where this many people with this many backgrounds can come together around an essential problem. Community development projects are perhaps the most productive opportunities. There is a handout on the table here called Making Up for Lost Time. It's the story of the Seattle King County Health Department and a program that they have developed in community development in low-income neighborhoods in collaboration with a wide range of other people doing interventions. So I would recommend those of you in health departments who are sitting here and say, yeah, I understand the logic of all this, but we don't do that. Take a look at what Seattle King County is doing and see if you don't find there might be a public health mission there that's appropriate to what your perspectives are. Now let's talk about what are those housing and neighborhood impacts. These are all things that ultimately have health effects as well as other effects. But stability and safety of a neighborhood is the one thing. That ranges everything from the physical quality of the environment to the availability of adequate police protection to adequate lighting so you don't have dark alleyways and so forth. So stability and safety is an important issue of this. Construction soundness and energy conservation. That's not just, put that together with, there's one down here, it says, well, I don't see it on this, with green construction. That's not just something for us folks to think about when we build our house and we want to make it energy conservation and want to make it green and so forth. It has a strong public health implication there. An example comes to mind. I'm retired 6 years, so I haven't been out there with the troops lately. But before I retired, we had a project in a low-income neighborhood in Houston, which is where I live. It was the School of Public Health was there, and the School of Nursing was there. And the School of Nursing had a project where their students would pair up with women, retired women, living alone in their houses, and see what they could do to assist them about health things and other things. And one of the things they learned is that houses tend to break down, whether you're rich or poor. Stairwells tend to become unstable and unsteady. And so one of the things these students did was just did an assessment of the structural soundness from a safety point of view so that these women wouldn't suddenly fall down the stairs when a stair gave way or something like that. And that probably had as much impact on health as the flu shot. I shouldn't say that. I know it's heresy, but but if you think about it a little bit, injury in elderliness, injury in other situations is an important health hazard, and it has a determinant, which is a sound structural environment in which to live and walk around in and do your thing. So that's one of the neighborhood impacts. Walkability. Getting exercise in order to avoid that heart attack or to live longer is not just for middle-class folks. You will find, however, as you know, that in many low-income neighborhoods, there is no such thing as a place to walk just for the sake of walking. And so design of neighborhoods for walkability becomes an important issue for now and for the future. Access to better retail for food choices. This one is really tough. Given the impact of what we eat on our health. The access to food in low-income neighborhoods is limited pretty much to convenience stores. If you wanted to get a broader-based wholesome food diet, you really may not have a supermarket that has those items at your price range in your neighborhood. And so one of the things that health departments could do in collaboration with communities, in collaboration with other organizations, is develop economic incentives to bring in, to entice supermarkets to locate there. It will take extra money, I'm sure, but it's being done. And again, I'll refer you to that article. It has a lot more information about it. The other place that's doing a lot about this is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They have partnered up with an interesting partner, the United States Federal Reserve System. And they are having a series of conferences all over the country. I attended one in Houston about a month ago, where they go into all of this early development stuff. They go into the financing. They go into the better foods, the better neighborhoods, and so forth. And they invite people from other areas who have experience in there to talk about them. So I would suggest that you take a look at the Robert Wood Johnson projects along on community development. Access to safe and efficient public transportation. Low-income neighborhoods, I guess, don't get as good bus service, subway service, etc., as the rest of us do. On the other hand, they're the ones who need it the most, if not for any other reasons, to get to work for the rest of us who have it already. So transportation is a big item. You can begin to see that being healthy is really broader than we thought, even though we're all in public health and we are used to thinking broadly. But these are some of the things to begin to put into your thought processes and figure out ways you can partner with neighborhood groups, other groups, to develop such projects. And the model, the handout I gave you is at least one model of doing that. That comes out of Seattle. The parks, open spaces are the same issue as we have here. Now, I don't know what to do about location in industrialized areas. The location, if you're near a plant, it's always going to be cheaper to rent or whatever. But there's a challenge for somebody to say, what can we do to make neighborhoods safer from every point of view, from the point of view of the stability of injury, from the point of view of crime, from the point of view of exposure to the pollutants from the industry they're close to. What can you do about that? Well, this slide here is full of a million ways to think about changing the determinants of health, and hardly any of them are directly related to what you learned about when you learned about public health or clinical medicine. Okay, now, having said all this, does it work? You know, it's a great thing for my bleeding heart to respond to and say, this will just make the world wonderful if we just get out there and work hard and think of all the new people we'll meet and the social benefits that will arise from that. Well, it goes beyond that. It turns out back in the last century, some landmark studies were done on social determinants. They didn't call it that. The Whitehall studies, 1 and 2. How many of you have heard of the Whitehall studies? Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. There's Whitehall 1, which was started in 1967, and they were discriminatory. They just did males. There were 18,000 males that worked for the British Civil Service. They separated into the cohorts by job level. Now, clearly, the people in the lower jobs didn't make as much money as the administrators in the highest jobs, but nobody was at poverty level. Nobody. And so the important thing to recognize here is that this is relatively free of the economic bias that goes into health. Whitehall 2 started 20 years later. It included quite a few civil servants. But this time, one-third of them were women. The first one was all men. So, and both of these studies are ongoing, generating reports, and so forth. What they found out, that there was a strong association between job grade and health outcomes. The people at the lowest civil service levels had three times the mortality rate as the administrators who told them what to do. So there's something there about status that impacts health that is to be learned about. That's a social determinant, no question about that. Nothing's come out of this now that says this is how we ought to restructure society, do something about this. But it's still ongoing. A guy named Marmot was in charge of it. Since that time, he has gone on to the WHO, where he chairs their Commission on Social Determinants. I guess I meant to mention at the outset that everybody and his dog is into this now. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, I mentioned them. The the WHO, the Institute of Medicine, APHA, Department of Health and Human Services, all of them now have come up with references, resources, research to define what's the problem, what are the solutions, what can we do about it. And there is, did we circulate that reference list that I had? Or is it back there on the table? Source of references? Okay. Well, if you want, I've got a list of about 18 references that you can look into this. If you can get back to Catherine with a request, we'll be happy to send it to you. Okay. So that's the storyline right there. So what we'd like to do now is get into a workshop mode and ask you to give us your feedback about what you think about this, what you might be doing, what your suggestions might be for what ought to be done about it. So I will turn this over to Catherine. This, we thought we were going to have a workshop where everybody broke into little groups and sat around tables. And so I wrote down a thing here of what you might discuss. And it's, here they are. First of all, is there an understanding among public health workers of the distinction between social determinants and traditional determinants of health that drive health department programming? Second, what is the view of your group about this distinction? What are the benefits? What are the downsides? Is there a role for state public health associations in assisting local and state health departments to review the use of social determinants in public health department programs at both local and state levels? So the issue is implementation of some of these ideas. What do you think about it? And who can do it? And how should it be done? Or is it all pie in the sky?
So the other purpose of the group today was to sort of come up with a take-home plan that you could take back to your state associations with some ideas for how to address some of the social determinants of health, and your state association could work with health departments, both state and local, to implement some things that might actually help make the their communities healthier. So I think what we might do is first start out. We've got two note takers up here, and what we will do will be to just kind of go around and ask for you all to perhaps tell us some of the things that your state associations have done that have been successful, have perhaps had an impact in making communities healthier. And we'll jot those down, and right at the end, we're going to read off some ideas so that you can take some of those back to your state association. So it's going to be a really interactive thing. So hopefully you all are in your interactive mode and can start out. Who's going to start out by telling us what your health department have been doing or your state associations have been doing to interact with your health department? Somebody. I know y'all are doing great work.
I'm not sure this fits your question as well, because my state, the state association isn't doing a lot, I mean, partially because the people who work there are government employees. We don't have a very good part of our state where they might get in trouble if they were to be active.
Might I ask you to come up to the podium?
Oh.
I don't think everybody can hear me, okay?
Our challenge is that at the state level, the people involved are mostly government employees, and therefore they have to be very careful about what they say to involve policy, because a lot of these things change, or involve policy changes to really make a difference. Otherwise, you're just kind of talking about it. So I honestly, on the nonprofit side, because of that, because if I were to become a state employee, I'd have to risk getting in trouble and fired by the governor or the mayor if I were to be vocal about some of these things. So,
what state are you with?
Nebraska.
Has Nebraska's state or Nebraska Public Anybody else? Yeah.
I'm from the Kentucky Public Health Association, and Kentucky was a former tobacco producing state. I say former because I think we've pretty well gotten out of the business. But two of the most influential activities that we undertook in that regard, several years ago, we got the ball rolling by having a statewide conference, and it involved the state health department, local health departments, more importantly, members of the local boards of health, other local community representatives, and we had a lot of support from restaurants who had already gone smoke-free, and at this time, we had no anti-smoking legislation. And we weren't about to get any statewide legislation because the legislature felt that this should be a local issue. So out of that conference came the decision on the part of the second largest city in the state, Lexington, which is a merged metro government, city-county, and they passed a rather comprehensive anti-smoking legislation, including bingo halls and bars. We got a lot of flack. The health department has to enforce it. They had a little trouble at first, but had to go to court a couple of times. But anyway, that got the ball rolling. Then a couple of years ago, there was another move underway, brought mainly by the Tobacco Free Kentucky Coalition, which is again community-wide, statewide community-wide, driven by the two major universities, but other universities and public health agencies. We once again tried to, and we're right now, we just had a session and I haven't heard the outcome of that, but we tried to get another statewide bill passed. In the meantime, though, the effects of these, and the second set of conferences was not statewide, it was regional. We had six of them. And we had people from some of our other states, like Tennessee, which has gotten a statewide ban passed. And so we had local conferences, very, very heavy turnout from local board of health members. And in Kentucky, what we can do is if the city won't pass an ordinance, the health department can pass an ordinance. We started out with just the one community, and the last time I counted, we were up to like 34 communities, either counties or cities or combinations that have anti-smoking legislation. So that's the way our health, that's just one of the examples of the way our public health association has involved the community in driving some of these things.
Did you have an external funding source, or did your public health association fund all those?
We had external funding sources primarily through the Smoke Free Kentucky Coalition. They put up a lot of money, and we put up some. We also got some grants for the second go around. We used some of our grant monies from other sources. I think we had some Robert Wood Johnson funds in that. And since those were regional conferences, they worked very well. Those were the primary funding sources.
So that he was partnering with another group.
Absolutely. Now we don't take all the credit, but we joined with the other groups, and collectively, I think we were able to bring about some.
Question. Is that a state statute that the health department can make the ruling instead of the city?
I'm not sure if it's statute. Local health departments have the authority to pass any kind of a ruling that affects the health of the community. Whether or not a local board of health in a given county. Now, Kentucky has 120 counties. We've also got regional health departments. Every county, by law, has a board of health. Regional health departments are where multiple counties, two or more counties, have gone in together and formed a regional board of health, and they have members from each of those local boards of health. But a local board of health has the right or the obligation to pass any kind of a ruling that will affect the public's health in that community. What we faced in Kentucky is that several communities are afraid to deal with it through a public health mandate. And then you get into the political arena. But the local board of health can really pass any kind of a ruling for just within their own limitations that has an impact on the health of the community.
Anybody else?
I'm Stephen Keener from North Carolina, and I don't really have anything to say about what's been done, but really kind of more questions about what should we be doing, because some of the important things that were pointed out during this really great presentation were things like housing and jobs, you know, in terms of income, places where people can get exercise, like parks, and those are things that traditionally are not in under public health's control, you know, budgetarily or administratively. We had an urban renewal project. You know, that's nothing that comes through health departments. When you're talking about creation of jobs, that's nothing that we traditionally think this is part of our work. And more importantly, it's not recognized by by our bosses, you know, our boards of health or our county governments, nor this. It's mainly cities that do HUD things and urban renewal and housing partnerships. They don't really have the understanding that what they're doing is a determinant of people's health either. So I guess my question to myself is, well, you know, what should we be doing differently with respect to our partnerships to kind of get a better understanding about how this actually affects people's health?
Okay, I had a comment.
I'm glad you asked the question. I mean, I'm no expert in this subject for sure, but it just made me think that, we need to be doing more collaborations with other city or governmental departments other than just public health. I mean, as the Public Health Association, we should be collaborating with the natural resources department and the parks and recreation and agriculture and whatever governmental entity there is in your city or state, whatever, when we're talking state public health, you know, we should be collaborating with them. I think the gentleman who gave the presentation implied that there needs to be, you know, more collaboration. And
And Dr. Lowe actually does have something he'd like to add to that question.
I think you have commented on part of
yes.
The social determinants really imply roles that are not familiar with other roles, or obligations and mandates that are not currently in law for them to do. So the issue is, if the perspective is that these items will impact health positively, what do you do to figure out how to play the role, either with somebody else or changing, getting some a law change, or getting the mandate to the health department broadened a bit and so forth. And you have to be really sure that the juice is going to be worth the squeeze, or you're going to get in trouble about it, or you're just not going to be successful. But there are enough examples, like the article I put out on the paper, where health departments have figured out a way to do it with others. You're never going to do it by yourself. It's not in Public Health 101. But maybe in 10 years it will be. Public Health 101, how do you relate to other organizations in the community? How do you particularly relate to the legislature, the political end of the world? And it could be easy, but the benefit, it seems to be, is fantastic.
We had a comment here, and then we'll go to the back.
Yeah. That was, excuse me. I was recently hired. I think I agree completely with the comments that have been made about how important it is to start bridging those divides between more traditional public health and the other sectors. And I just wanted to share a resource that I found very helpful in doing that. Many of you may know it already, but if you've seen the Unnatural Causes series about the social determinants of health, I found the Place Matters film short and really valuable to start that conversation with people who don't see the connection of their own work to public health. So it doesn't always work, but I think that just to start the conversation about why should you be at your table or why should you be at ours. Called Place Matters. Place Matters is part of the series called Unnatural Causes. I think it was produced by California Israel.
There is a resource that I could be helpful. If anyone goes to Washington State, the Seattle Housing Authority has a community called High Point Neighborhood, and it is a perfect example of what we're talking about, a community that was revitalized basically from the standpoint of there was a lot of violence in the community. And so over the course of, I think it's been about 10 years, just to transform the community with money they had from the housing authority, but they brought in what we would call construction workers, you know, everyone from the city, county, state, et cetera, was connected. And so it built this, this new collaborative effort that has now helped to maintain partnerships and relationships that was initially based on, okay, what are we going to do about this particular housing development that there's a high crime rate, to now it's a place where everyone wants to live, mixed use housing facility. It's built environment, it's the kids there are healthier because they have pretty easy equipment in their homes, and so the environment is necessary. So it connects all the social determinants of health, but it was really based on looking at an issue in the community, but also built in partners.
And that was in Washington
State? It's in Washington State, in Seattle. And the community is called High Point. And I think it's in a medical college.
And they partnered with the Washington Public Health Association?
I don't know about that, but I know that they partnered with the city, the state. I don't know what to do with their association in general. But it's a great example of looking at what we have and trying to fit in different social determinants around that.
Right.
I was
going to say, a lot of us
need
to start thinking about what we're going to do as far as interventions. Our first thought is, where's the money? Where can I get the money to do it? But we need to also, there's a lot of things you can do that don't require any money. I'm a communication person, so I always think of communication. And it takes nothing to go and take just a little bit of time, go and spend some time talking with people, educating them about proper nutrition and exercise and that sort of thing. And from a marketing standpoint, if you educate a community, for instance, that does not live in the food desert or does not have good access to good quality food, the importance of fresh fruits and vegetables and that sort of thing. And they encourage them to go tell the store managers, we need fresh fruits and vegetables because, you know, we will buy them and we will put them in the store. And then encourage them to start asking for them and then purchasing, you know, when they come along, demanding that they get a price that they can afford. They may not have the variety, they may not have star fruit, you know, all the other kind of stuff, but they can get fresh spinach and lettuce and turnip greens and those sort of things, and they can ask for good, and some good fresh fruit. But you train people to go and ask for what they want, build the market, and market is there, and then they can get what they want. And that doesn't cost anything to people for some time.
So the state association could then train trainers,
right,
so to speak,
the whole
use their expertise in the association to train trainers to go out. That's a great example.
Just one other thing that came to mind, Catherine, is that we've only done it now for 2 years in Kentucky, but it's one of the best reaching out efforts that I've ever seen. In Kentucky, we've got a statewide group called the Kentucky Chamber. It's basically the statewide chamber of commerce made up of chambers all over the state, but also very influential members such as the Kentucky Department Board of Education, or Kentucky Education Association, all of these statewide committees, Farm Bureau, you reach across the board, and so we are at the table. We're a paid member in that organization, and we participate in their annual conference, and it has given public health a visibility clear that we could have never had before. And we joined with the Kentucky Health Departments Association, which is an association of our departments of public health, in joining the Kentucky Chamber. And that has paid super dividends, because it's almost our calling card to go into almost any community and do a joint effort with all sorts of agencies. I mean, who would have thought that public health would be working with the Kentucky Farm Bureau? But again, it's an important group to link with. So that just came to mind, and I encourage your state associations, if you've got, I know you've got every state's got a statewide group, sort of as a blanket group, and I would ask that you consider going that avenue, because it has paid us super dividends. It's very politically active, too.
Some good ideas going. Okay, so we've already gotten some ideas of where to start. Public health associations might establish train the trainer types of programs. What might be an idea for a health department to, if they do need funding, to get some funding? If they don't have a dedicated grant writer, what might be some ideas? Partnering with groups who do have money, like the Chambers of Commerce, the Farm Bureau, I think that's a great idea. And some of the others that were mentioned, the Housing Authority, those are some great ideas.
Department of Agriculture, their extension.
Parks and Recreation, definitely.
We have with the ATV thing, just saying, it's a part of a very unusual group, part of the State Sheriff Association and State Police Association. You know, there are certain things that they need. So look outside the norm, you know,
right.
People who aren't, like Chambers of Commerce, who aren't necessarily health organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So look for those, you know, outside the norm, do that.
That's a great idea.
So you have that one common interest with, and just that one little thing, and get that little foot the door, and you can find other things.
Did everybody hear the talk yesterday by the park department? Yeah, I loved that. Take a hike and call me in the morning.
We've also, from Scott, we've also leveraged funding through partnerships with the hospital system for maternal and child health initiatives, state food campaigns, home visitation staff, things like that. And it seems that with one of our home visitation programs, it seems that the more that we leverage, the more we can leverage without writing additional grants. So, you know, you become a little more visible with one gift from the hospital, and we were able to leverage another 2 years for a team of a social worker and a nurse to do home visitation, prenatal care coordination, things like that. So it just kind of, you start one relationship and then it kind of perpetuates. Hopefully, indefinitely.
All right. Well, you all have had some fantastic ideas. I'm excited to take them back to Texas. I hope you all got all that. Okay, so Dr. Lowe, for any last comments that you might want to make on anything that's been said, and then we'll start hearing some of the highlights that you can take back with you to your state association.
Well, I think the biggest problem, the biggest issue is about operationalizing social determinants is residents to know how to do it, residents to do it, connect with them, how to do that. And I've encouraged them to respond to the petition you all understand. You understand how to do that. something like social determinants, or whether you'd like to have free heart readers for everyone. Looks like you've got a device that can work in terms of doing things along.
First of all, I'd like to thank Lori McNeil and Kay Reynolds from the Texas Public Health Association, who have been taking numerous notes here. And I think kind of the gauge of how successful you were with getting a group to interact and share ideas was how many notes were taken. And Lori said, I don't know what's most important. I've got so much here. So I think we all did a really great job, and I think the key that I can think of that I heard was partnering is the big deal. And I know at the Texas Public Health Association, we kind of get hung up on the fact that we don't have a lot of money to do anything. And I don't think we have done a very good job there of partnering with groups like the Farm Bureau and a bunch of Department of Agriculture and a bunch of those departments that we really could. And I don't think I ever really thought about it, because I was one of the people hung up on not having any money to do it. So those were great ideas.
Yeah, I think one of the big things I heard is, from Kentucky and everywhere else is, and Dr. Lowe said too, the health departments don't really have the mandate to do a lot of these things, and the health associations certainly don't, but finding that person who does, and then educating and working with them so that they're on your side and we'll start implementing, even if it starts small. And it's amazing how things will snowball. Kind of like we heard with Project Contagion, get viral. Little things start going and they start moving. So finding those people that have the authority over a particular area sounds like a major point.
Maybe the next speech ought to be, if you don't have a mandate, get one.
Yes.
Yeah, that was one of the notes that I had put down. If you don't have one, you gotta have a policy to help create a policy. And the other thing also is the point that was made about the utilizing all the things you can without thinking about things in terms of money so much. I like that comment about use those things that resources are available that are free. But right. Remember those. Don't forget in your process of trying to plan. Think about dollars that are what is free that you have.
I don't agree with
that.
And using the expertise within your association.
I missed the handout, so I don't know if they're in.
Oh, they're on the back.
No, there aren't any back there.
Oh, there aren't any?
I was sitting. Will the presentation be online somewhere on APHR? Can I just get my jump drive connection?
Online affiliate. You can have my copy.
Okay, and then I was impressed with that last slide that I really thought about the Public Health Association's role as being to help others understand the social determinants of health. That was kind of intriguing for me, because I hadn't thought of that before and I hadn't heard anyone say that before. Did you say that, sir, professionals, did you say that some agency had come up with that role for the public health agency? I mean, the Public Health Association?
I don't recall that it's a particular focus of that kind. It just seems that when you get that many different public health folks together